19, the day after the heart procedure, I picked him up at the hospital, and everything seemed fine. But a massive, irreversible brain bleed had begun. We rushed him to the hospital, and by the time we got him there, and the doctors looked at him, it was too late, and my dad never spoke again. Dad passed away 6 short and turbulent days later. Last words are important. As I think back to that cloudy weekend, trying to remember what my father's last words were, what I can recollect were that he spoke words of praise, words of home, and words of rest. As he was in his hospital bed getting ready to go home, I showed him a video of Josh and Ethan's concert they had performed the night before. So while he was waiting for the nurses to come and to get him checked out, he spoke some words of praise. He also spoke words of home, that he was ready to go home and see my mom. And he spoke words of rest. Words of praise, words of home, words of rest. My last words experience with my loved one is not unique. And I'm confident that there are many of you here who have had similar last words experiences with your loved ones. And so for tonight's lesson, I want you to set your mind and your heart back to one of those moments and think about last words. And not only for those of you that have experienced that, but for those of you that haven't experienced that, I want you to imagine what that would be like, or to think if you were to speak your last words, who would you speak them to and what would you say? Last words are important. Turn your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 1. In Deuteronomy chapter 1 and in verse 1, we're going to be studying from this book of Deuteronomy. And the book of Deuteronomy is a book of last words. We read at verse 1, it says, "These are the words that Moses spoke." What we find is that here is a book that's not just what you would think about in reference to a book that's just retelling laws and regulations, but actually we have a 120-year-old man, who's a father, who's a grandfather, who's a family man, who's a shepherd over a flock, and he is gathering his strength to stand before the children of Israel one last time and speak his last words. These are the words that Moses spoke. These are not just any words, and they're not just from any person, and they're not just on any occasion. We continue reading in Deuteronomy chapter 1, we find out the occasion of this last word moment. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness. In the Arabah, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hezeroth, and Dizahab. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. In the 14th year, on the first day of, or I'm sorry, in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses spoke to the people of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment to them, after he had defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Beyond the Jordan, in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to explain this law. Moses stood up to speak his last words. And we know that this is the case because as you read through the book of Deuteronomy in Deuteronomy chapter 31, we find that he is speaking his last words. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 31. The book of Deuteronomy is a book of last words. So Moses continued to speak these words to all Israel. And he said to them, "I am 120 years old today. I'm no longer able to go out and to come in. The Lord has said to me, 'You shall not go over this Jordan.' The Lord your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy those nations before you so that you shall dispossess them, and Joshua will go over you at your head, as the Lord has spoken, and the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and their land when he had destroyed them. And the Lord will give them over to you, and you shall do to them according to the whole commandment that I have commanded you. And so this 120-year-old man stands up giving his last words, and it says in verse 6, "Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you." These are the last words of Moses. And then look at chapter 32 and in verse 48. In chapter 32 and verse 48, as he finishes his speaking, it says, "That very day the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go up to this mountain of Abiram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab opposite Jericho, and view the land which I am giving to the people of Israel for a possession, and die on the mountain which you go up.'" And so as he completes his words, his message to the people, God says, on that very day, you're going to go up and you're going to die. And then that's what takes place in chapter 34 and in verse 5, where Moses goes up on the mountain and he views the promised land and he dies. Moses is speaking in Deuteronomy, a book about last words. And so that is our first point. As we recognize, I want you to think about this book. A lot of times when we think about the book of Deuteronomy, we think about it in a sense of hesitation. As you look at what you read about in the book of Leviticus, and you have laws about things that are written under a different covenant, about things that don't necessarily apply to us today. And so when we look at the book of Deuteronomy, we see, well, it's a second telling of the law. Why do we need to study from the book of Deuteronomy? But instead of looking at it as a book of regulations, I want you to look at it as an opportunity that Moses has to preach this final sermon. So think about those times where you have that faithful gospel preacher that's been preaching for years, and you remember that moment when he finally gets to get up and gives his last sermon, and how important that is, and what he's going to say is very valuable, and you remember that. This is that moment for Moses. So the book of Deuteronomy, as we're going to be studying this weekend in reference to this book, is a book that tells us things that are important to him, his last words. But not only is it a book of his last words, this is a book of last words about something important, and it's a book of last words about family. I want to prove it to you that that's where we're headed. This is a book that's talking about family. Notice that the speaker is connected to family. Notice that the audience that he's speaking to is connected to family. And notice that throughout all the book of Deuteronomy, the subject is connected to things related to family. Deuteronomy is a book of last words about family. Moses himself, we look at him and recognize what a great leader he was and how he served the people and spoke as a prophet, and he was a mediator and all the things that he did as he delivered God's people. But we need to remember that Moses was a 120-year-old man, that he was a grandfather, that he was a father, that he was a brother, that he was a cousin, that he had children, that he had grandchildren, and that he understood about family. What would you say to your children and to your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren if you had one last opportunity to exhort them to stay faithful in the faith, to stay faithful in their service to God? Moses, the speaker, is connected to family. Also, the audience is connected to family. You read through the book in chapter 1 and verse 3, the people of Israel are called the children of Israel. And several times throughout the book, God's nation, if you try to find terms to describe who they are, they're described as children. They're described in the context of family. Also in chapter 3 and verse 18, there's reference to God's people being called brothers and brethren. So throughout the book, they're called brothers, sisters, they're called children, and they were there 40 years after they had come out of the land of Egypt. And remember the makeup of this audience. The audience is connected to family. What do you think they're thinking about? The adults that were 20 years of age and above, who had come out of the land of Egypt, had all died in the wilderness. And so here is a new generation who on average would be age 40 and under, a young group of families. And they are thinking about their parents and their grandparents who are no longer with them. And they are thinking about family. They are husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, children, siblings, brothers and sisters. The audience is made up of families. And not only that, but the subject, the speaker is connected to family, the audience is connected to family, and then the subject matter in the book of Deuteronomy is connected to things that are related to family. In chapter 5, we're going to see a retelling of the Ten Commandments. And in those Ten Commandments, there are commandments connected to your wife and to your husband and to your children and to honoring your parents, that the book of Deuteronomy is filled with laws about how you eat, about family laws, about family worship, about connection with how families interact with your neighbors, all these different things. The book of Deuteronomy is the Torah lived out on a family level. And so these are things that would be connected to family to give us application for us to think about. Deuteronomy is a book of last words, and Deuteronomy is a book of last words about family. And so for the next few lessons this weekend, we're going to be looking at some of those last words of Moses that help us understand why we need to study this book and how it applies to our families today. And so for the rest of our lesson, we're going to look at one of those points that he makes in chapters 1 through 3. And that point that he makes in chapters 1 through 3 is that family should not be first. He makes the point, and it sounds shocking, but in Deuteronomy chapter 1 through 3, he takes the people, his audience, made up of family members, and he wants to tell them one thing, and he's telling them this point, don't put your family first. And that sounds shocking to us, because you would think that that's the most important thing that we should do. But we're going to learn that we need to put God first and our family second. Moses is speaking to a crowd, and they're at the east side of the Jordan, and he is going to tell them a history lesson. And he's going to tell them to remember the families that stood outside the border of the Promised Land 40 years ago, and they had a choice to make. He's going to be comparing this Exodus family with this new Promised Land family. He's going to be comparing the parents and the grandparents with this new younger generation. One set of families did not have faith, and they drew back. And now Moses, having to suffer through 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, is about to leave that nation of Israel. And so he is going to give them this exhortation, and he's going to tell them that they need to stay faithful and not draw back. So we want to read about that starting in verse 19. You are standing tonight at the border of the Promised Land, and you're going to have to make a decision about what kind of family you're going to have. Are you going to be a faithless family, or are you going to be a faithful family? When the storms of life come into your path, are you going to march on in to the Promised Land and trust in God? Or are you going to be like that faithless family that shrunk back? When the giants of the land are sent in by Satan, will you stay faithful or will you shrink back? In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 19, we find this history lesson that Moses tells him about. And notice he already made reference in chapter 1 and verse 2, that it was only an 11-day journey from Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. It should have only taken them 11 days to get from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. But the faithless generation, because they drew back, it's taken them 40 years. When you're a faithless family, the result is that your family will suffer. So let's begin reading in Deuteronomy chapter 1. And in verse 19, then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrifying wilderness that you saw. On the way to the hill country of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is giving us. See, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and take possession as the Lord, the God of our fathers, has told you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Then all of you come near to me and said, let us send men before us that we may explore the land. All right, great. He's retelling what happened to this first generation. And as he does this, he tells about the choices that they made in turning away from God. Verse 22, then all of you came near to me and said, let us send men before us that we may explore
the land for us and bring us word again by the way which we must go up into cities which we will come. And the thing seemed good to me, and I took 12 men from you, one man from each tribe, and they turned and went up into the hill country and came into the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. And they took in their hand some of the fruit of the land and brought it down to us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land that the Lord your God is giving us. Yet you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where we are going up, our brothers have made our hearts melt. The people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and terrified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. Then I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God, who goes before you, will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where you have seen how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son, all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out, place to pitch your tents, fire and in the night, a cloud by day to show you what way you should go. So he's telling them a story about not putting their family first. Notice that this is a threefold story of seconds. First of all, they took a second guess. Notice whose idea was it for them to enter in to send the spies in? Moses said that it was the people's idea. And then Moses said, well, that sounds good to me, so you send the spies in. God had promised this land to them, to Abraham, hundreds of years before, and he already told them that they were going to be victorious. Why did they need to send spies in the first place? Faithless families second guess God's promises. Think about that point here. This is an example of these families at the crossroads that drew back. The first thing is they second guess what God had promised to them. So in your family, whatever situation you're in, we're all a part of different kinds of families. Whether you have grandchildren, children, you come from family, you have family, you're connected in different family relationships, you have children making decisions about their school, you may be making decisions about your job, all these different things that you're doing, you have to decide, are you going to trust God's promises? You're at the crossroads. You see storms, you see giants, you see fortified cities, and what are you going to do? Too many times we want to second guess whatever God's will is for us. You say, well, I don't know if the roles of women should be like we traditionally have followed in the scriptures. Maybe we should change that. And so we start second-guessing God's plan. Notice not only did they second-guess and sent the spies in, then they took a second take on the plan. Because when the 10 spies came back, there was the 12, but 10 of them said, oh no, we can't do it. And so then they said, oh well, the report made our heart melt, and so we need to rethink the whole plan. They took a second guess. They took a second take on the whole plan. And then notice also that the text tells us that they murmured in their tents all night. And then they approached Moses and said, we're not going in. So this Deuteronomy account tells us that they took some time to think about this. And who would have been in their tents? Their families. Why did they not go in? Hebrews chapter 3, verse 18 tells us that they didn't go in because of unbelief. And we also read here that they didn't go in because they did not believe in the Lord in verse 32. Notice, so we know they didn't believe because of these seconds, but what I think is that the main reason they didn't go in is because they were worried about their wives and their children. Notice, we keep reading, verse 34. And the Lord heard your words and was angered. And he swore, not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land that I swore to give your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and to his children I will give the land in which he has trodden, because he has wholly followed the Lord. Even with me, the Lord was angry on your account and said, you shall not go in there. Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter. Encourage him for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. This is the point, verse 39. And as for your little ones, who you said would become prey. Think about that for a minute. They said that their children would become prey if they do what God told them to do. They follow God's plan. They're saying, God, if we do what you want us to say, then you're going to make our children prey. You're going to make our children be slaughtered. Their thinking is following God's plan will lead to destruction of my family. And as for your little ones who you said would become prey, and your children who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there, and to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn and journey into the wilderness, the direction of the Red Sea. So God's upset with them, and he says, you don't trust me? Go back to the wilderness, and you're going to go back there, and you're going to die in the wilderness. You don't want the promised land? You're at this crossroad. You've doubted me, and you're worried about that. But notice what the key is, I believe, is that it's because they were worried about their children and their wives, and so they put their family first above God. Notice, when you put your family first, what's going to happen to your family? When they put their family first, they sent their children into suffering in the wilderness for 40 years, and they had to end up becoming orphans because they had to bury their own parents and their grandparents in these unmarked graves. Their children suffered because they put them first. Think about the priorities that you make in reference to your family, and know that when you put your family first, it causes problems and it will make your family suffer. What kind of family do you have as you are at this crossroads, as we analyze this point? Do you have a family that is a family of chaos and strife? Or do you have a family that is one of peace and love? Do you have a family, do you have a marriage that is a reflection of the glory of the relationship between Christ and the church? Or do you have a marriage that is empty and broken? Is your house built on the rock? Is your marriage built on the rock? And look at your children. Are your children angry, bitter, and disengaged? Or are they engaged in the work of the Lord, ready to take up the sword of the Spirit, to put on the armor of God, and to go out into the world to carry on in the work for the next generation? What kind of family do you have? Do you have a family of doubt or a family of faith? As we establish this point about their little ones, I want to look at a couple other passages that show that it's because of their children that they refuse to go in. Look at the Numbers account. In Numbers chapter 14, verses 1 through 3, they make the same argument explaining why they will not go into the promised land. And it's because they put their family ahead of God. Numbers 14 in verse 1, then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. So that would refer back to how they complained in their tents. And all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to one another, let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. So God told the previous generation to go, and they said no. God told them that he promised them that they would have safety, and they doubted. And God told them yes to go in, and they said no. What kept them from doing what God said? It was their family. They put their family first, and as a result, their children suffered. So I want you to think about situations in your life, and you say, this is a real problem in reference to how we interact with God. When you are having trouble in your marriage, are you going to put your will or your wife's will or your husband's will first? Or are you going to trust in God? Are you going to put your children ahead of God? Or are you going to put yourself ahead of God? Or are you going to put others ahead of God? When the storms attack your marriage, will God be in first place or second place? And when the giants come, will God be in the first place or the second place? And when the giants come, do you say, wait a minute,
I know what God's plan is for me in reference to serving His will and what my role is in my family, but I am going to second guess, I'm going to second take, and I'm going to have a second look. What happens is when you put God second, and you put God, when you put your family first, you're putting God in second place. You say, well, what's so bad about putting God in second place? Doesn't God want me to have a good family? Doesn't God want me to have happy children and have a happy wife? But what do athletes say about second place? I just looked up some quotes. Olympians and athletes, professional athletes, they say second place is just the first of the losers. Or if you're first, you're first, but if you're second, you're nothing. If you ain't first, you're last. No one remembers second place. The family first mentality does three things. The first thing it does is it brings a curse. When parents put their children first, their children are going to end up last. That's what happened to the wilderness family. When parents put their children first, their children are going to suffer. We already read it. We go back to Numbers chapter 14. In Numbers 14, we're going to read verses 31 through 33. Again, it makes reference to how they felt about their children. But your little ones, whom you said will be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land in which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. So instead of their children, they'd have done what God said, instead of their children growing up in the fruitful land of milk and honey, their children became victims and prey in the wilderness, and they suffered. Instead of seeing their parents grow old with strength and dignity and abundance, they had to watch their parents and grandparents wander around without dignity, losing their life, dying in the wilderness. We want our loved ones to have long, happy lives and to have dignity. And we want them to have respect. And we want them to leave this world with dignity. But how did this generation leave? Could you imagine losing your home, wandering homeless in the desert, and burying your parents in unmarked tombs? No respect. And this story teaches us that when you have the family first mentality, it brings a curse. So let me give some examples of this. You see it in the scriptures where people would put their family ahead of God. For example, Ananias and Sapphira. They made a pact that they were going to be deceptive about their money and lie about what they were given to God. And remember, they were confronted each individually, and Ananias and Sapphira, they stood with one another, and as a result, they both lost their lives. Instead of one saying no to the mate, no, we're going to put God first, I'm not going to lie with you, and I'm not going to be deceptive with you, and as a result, they both lost their lives. Does that not happen in marriages where one mate may be leading the other into sin? And out of a desire to please the mate, one says nothing, like Adam and Eve, where it appears that Adam, he says, was with her. And so why didn't Adam speak up and stop his wife in this temptation or warn her? Perhaps he wanted to please his wife, and so he puts his wife first, and as a result, his wife is cursed, he's cursed, the land is cursed. We see all the consequences that come into the world because of sin, because a man put his wife above God. But if he had put God first, you think, well, that sounds selfish. You should put your wife first. But if he'd have put God first, then that would be the best thing he could do for his wife. Is that not right? You look at this and you see the importance of putting God first and not your family. Don't live for your spouse, live for God. Ahab put Jezebel above God, and as a result, Jezebel was cursed. Ahab was cursed. Solomon put his foreign wives above God. And look at all the consequences that came upon him. We see the importance of that. And so in your marriage, you have to put God first. And in doing that, that's the best thing you can do for your mate and for your family. Don't live for your spouse, live for God. Don't live for your children, live for God. Lot, remember when in Genesis 18 and 19, when Lot's servants were arguing with Abraham's servants, and Abraham said, let's go our separate ways, let's be at peace, and you pick where you want to go. Where did Lot go? He went to the well-watered plains of Sodom. Why would he go there?
If he's thinking from a family man, provide for my family perspective, that's a wise financial move. Let's go to this area where I can provide for my family and my have my flocks being taken care of. So he put, I would say in that case, thinking family first without thinking about the consequences that that would have upon his family from a sinful, worldly perspective. And in the end, he loses everything and he's hiding out in caves, an ashamed, sinful man. Lot chose the well-watered plain of Sodom instead of putting God first. Or Eli, remember his story where he refused to restrain his sons? And you just look through that story and think, well, why wouldn't he do that? Why wouldn't he stand up to his sons? But yet as parents, we could see perhaps we're in situations where we feel limited in what we could do for discipline and we allow ourselves to be limited. And instead of putting God first, he put his sons first. And what happens? We read about how his sons take the Ark of God into battle, and then his sons are slaughtered. The Ark of the Covenant is captured by the Philistines. The Israelites lose in battle. Eli hears the news, and he falls over dead. You put your children first, and that causes great damage. The best thing you can do for your children is put God first. And so family first mentality brings a curse. Not only does family first mentality bring a curse, but family first mentality dethrones God. When you put your family above God, what you're doing is you're taking God off of his rightful throne and you're putting your wife on the throne or your husband on the throne or your children. And in essence, what you're doing is you're dethroning God and you're turning your family into an idol. You're turning your children into a position where they're running the family, and as a result, they end up growing up worshiping themselves because the parents are serving them and not restraining them or disciplining them. The family first mentality dethrones God. What happens is you elevate your family above God. You insult God by removing him from his rightful place, and you set unrealistic expectations. Say you're a new young married couple and you just worship your wife, and you let her lead you away from the Lord, or vice versa. You let your husband lead you away from the Lord and make bad decisions that are taking your family away from a spiritual stronghold. And as a result, when you worship your mate, then you're putting them on a level of being a god, setting them to an area where they cannot meet those expectations, and they're doomed for failure. They are doomed for certain failure. A family first mentality dethrones God and causes great problems. We need to not do that. I think of an example of choices that people have to make about putting family before God. We read in the scriptures about how Matthew chapter 10 and verse 35, he who loves father or mother or children more than me is not worthy of me. So in the Philippines, I was acquainted with the story about a young lady who was a teenager, and she learned the truth, and she wanted to become a Christian. And her father was adamant, the opposed against her becoming a Christian. And so he forbade her that you cannot become a Christian. And he actually slept at the door of their little hut with a knife to forbid her, said, you will not leave this house, because he knew she wanted to go get baptized. And so she snuck out the back and went, and she became a Christian. And so the dad found out about it, and when she came home, he had taken all her clothes and her belongings and threw them out in the street, and said, you are no longer my child. So here's this teenager with this choice of serving God or serving family. And so she chose to serve the Lord. Well, what happened over the next following months and a couple of years, one by one, her brother, her sister, her mother, her family members all became Christians. And they came to see what was so important to her that she would be willing to make such a commitment. And so her brothers, her mom, they all became Christians because she put God first. And then one day, I don't know, maybe a couple years later, they're at worship services, and then here comes her dad. And what's he going to do? And he came, and he came forward, he obeyed the gospel, he became a Christian. And he realized the commitment about what his daughter made and the change that happened to her and his whole family, and he repented of that sin. The choice between family and God, if she had let her father be first in that decision about not becoming a Christian, then what would have happened to her family? None of them likely would have become Christians. But because she put God above her dad and God above her family, then one by one her family became Christians and her dad became a Christian. You see, the point is that putting your family first brings a curse. It dethrones God. And putting God first is the best thing that you can do for your family. So the family first mentality brings a curse. It dethrones God. And then finally, it denies blessing. Because when you're in a situation where you're going to say, you know what, I know God wants us to assemble, but my kids are really involved in all these sports and these ball games, and I got to let my boys chase this dream. And so you put that first. What are you doing to your family? You are denying your children the blessing, the opportunity to put God first and to receive blessing from God. When you're making choices about entertainment, when you're making choices about your career, where you're going to live, all these different things, we have to put God first. And when we have a family first mentality, it denies them divine blessing, because actually what it does is it arrogantly asserts that you or I think we know better than God. But when we go to God's word to find instruction about how to lead our families, then we know that God knows what's best. Putting God first is what's doing best for your family. And that is the same thing. They are not mutually exclusive. And we see that in Ezra chapter 8, as we're about to conclude. Ezra chapter 8, and in verses 21 to 23, this spirit we read about in Ezra is that when we go to God, He will, if we put Him first, show us what to do that would be best for our families. In Ezra chapter 8, and verse 21, that then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from Him the right way for us and our little ones. They fasted and asked God what they needed to do to bless their children and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king saying, the hand of our God is upon all those for good who seek Him, but His power and His wrath are against all those who forsake Him. We put God first, we bring blessing, not a curse, and we keep God in His rightful place. And so tonight we've learned three things as we've introduced this study of Deuteronomy, that Deuteronomy is not just a book of laws and regulations that have no meaning to us, but actually it is a moment in which this godly leader, a family man, a father, a grandfather, he speaks his last words, and they're worthy of our attention. Not only is it a book of last words, it's a book of last words that has a great deal to say about family and how the law of God looks as it's carried out on a day-to-day basis. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow night in Deuteronomy chapter 6, about how we demonstrate love to others in carrying out these practices of God's law on a day-to-day basis. So it's a book of last words. It's a book of last words about family. And then we learn that this first last word of family is God first, family second. The best thing that you can do for your family is to become a child of God. And you may see that you're standing at the crossroads and you're having to decide, am I going to draw back like that faithless generation? Or am I going to march forward, even though Satan may throw his storms at me and his giants? But as we read in Deuteronomy 31 and verse 6, hear these last words of Moses, as you may decide tonight that you need to be restored or you need to become a Christian. He says, be strong and of good courage. Do not fear or be afraid, for the Lord your God, He is He, the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Hear these last words of Moses. The best thing you can do for your family is to become a child of God. I think of Cornelius. The best thing he did for his family was to hear the truth, to respond to the gospel, and to be baptized into Christ. The best thing that the Philippian jailer did for his family was to hear the truth and to repent, to wash the stripes of Paul, and to become a Christian and be baptized that same hour of the night. Have you become a Christian? Will you make the sacrifice? You're standing at the border of the promised land. Will you draw back or will you stay faithful? Will you become a child of God? And if you are a Christian and you recognize that you have a marriage that is not what it should be, then what are you going to do to fix that? God's word is the answer. If you have children that are in trouble, or if you are a teenager and you need to get your life right, or your relationship with your parents or your brothers and sisters are not right, what are you going to do to fix that? We're going to find answers in the book of Deuteronomy that will help us understand the importance of putting God first. If you need to be restored, or you need to take the steps that we referred to in reference to the Philippian jailer or Cornelius to become a Christian tonight, we can make preparations ready and have you right with God so that you can enter into the promised land. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?